of desperate and drugged women, who, as Maria refers to her own beauty, quote, looked all right, end quote, and moved through their lives playing the proper parts. Like Ruth, Maria is self-absorbed and selfish, but she has a stronger awareness of these flaws. She enjoys watching a movie she starred in because, quote, the girl on the screen seemed to have a definite knack for controlling her own destiny, end quote. Just as Ruth often feels like she is someone else's character, Maria, as an actress, has had opportunities to become someone else's character to similar effect. As a fading green girl, Maria remains detached. She loves her daughter and mourns her mother. But like with Ruth in Green Girl, she approaches most of her relationships clinically with a bemused detachment. She rarely indicates a genuine interest in preserving her marriage and has little tolerance for the men in her life. When her lover, Les, leaves three messages, she asks her answering service to tell him she hasn't picked up her messages because, quote, she had nothing to say to any of them, end quote. After she has an abortion, she meets Les Goodwin, and he asks what's wrong with her. She says, quote, I am just very, very, very tired of listening to you all, end quote. What the people in her life label throughout the novel as insanity or selfishness reads quite clearly as weariness, a weariness of playing her part properly, of being on display, of being the ingenue and good green girl. The literature of abortion is complex. Certainly, there are novels like Richard Brautigan's The Abortion and John Irving's Cider House Rules, among others. These literary treatments of abortion often struggle to strike the proper balance between narrative and political message. Didion's treatment of the subject is far more nuanced. The message does not subsume the story. This is a story about abortion, but it is also a story about what happens to the green girl, who changes, but does not necessarily become any less powerless, empty, filled with longing. During the procedure, Maria is dispassionate. Quote, no moment more or less important than any other moment. All the same, the pain as the doctor scraped signified nothing beyond itself. No more constituted the pattern of her life than did the movie on television in the living room of this house in Encino. End quote. It is only after, when she realizes she has perhaps done something she would rather not have, that the emotional significance begins to affect her. And even then, she does not seem to know what to do with those emotions, so she dulls them through the liberal use of barbiturates. Even though her desires are often muted, Ruth has them. She longs for things, even if she does nothing to reach for her desires. Maria Wyeth longs for things she could not possibly reach for: a dead mother, a sick daughter, an aborted fetus. Like Ruth, Maria is willing to make herself prey, willing to be woman as victim. In a parking lot where several boys are vandalizing cars, Maria walks right toward them. She kept her eyes steady, her pace even, and when she found herself unlocking the car under their blank gaze, it was with extreme deliberation. As she slid into the driver's seat, she stared directly at each of them, one by one. And in that instant of total complicity, one of them leaned across the hood and raised a hand in recognition of what had passed between them, his palm out, inscribing an arc in the still air. When Maria emerges from such situations unscathed, there is a sense of disappointment that she cannot be freed from her weariness. Toward the end of Play It As It Lays, Maria has a one-night stand with an actor she doesn't even like. As dispassionate as Ruth fucking the bartender, Maria lies still beneath the actor. When he falls asleep, Maria takes his Ferrari and drives to Vegas, near where she is pulled over by a highway patrolman for speeding. The agent she shares with her husband, Freddie, comes to rescue her and finds Maria is, quote, still wearing the silver dress, and she was still barefoot, and her face was streaked with dust, end quote. On the flight back to Los Angeles, Freddie says he doesn't understand girls like Maria. He says, quote, I mean, there's something in your behavior, Maria. I would almost go so far as to call it, a very self-destructive personality structure. End quote. Maria doesn't bother to respond, and why should she? Freddie only has one idea about girls like Maria. He's not interested in trying to understand her as an actual person. We are left with Maria Wyeth in a psychiatric facility. She has committed a terrible crime. The people in her life think she is crazy, selfish, self-destructive. Maria is probably the sanest person in her sad group of lovers and friends. She wants nothing more than to get out and take her daughter and raise her. As the fallen green girl, Maria knows something Ruth could never know. In trying to explain herself, Maria says, I know what nothing means, and keep on playing. If Ruth is woman as Green Girl Rising, and Maria Wyeth is the green girl in Fall, the women of reality television are the green girls interrupted. Green girls at their most garishly exposed, cut open for the cameras, performing the best and worst parts of themselves for attention, to be seen, for love, to be adored, for fame, to be wanted. Reality television often gives the impression that, like gender, the whole of life is a performance. I love watching that performance. One where people reveal how we are willing to compromise ourselves for something as fleeting as fame. The Los Angeles mansion or the tropical jungle or the fading rock star's tour bus is the stage. And what a stage it is. Brightly lit, lurid, encouraging us to see the garish spectacle of life at its most artificially real. I watch it all. The faux highbrow fare of Bravo, the booze-soaked MTV programming, the glossy competition shows on CBS, the sleazy exploitative fare of VH1, and even the off-brand shows on lesser cable networks like Bad Girls Club and Sister Wives. No one shines more luridly on this faux real stage than a woman. Whether it's a modeling competition, a chance to compete for love, a weight loss challenge, or a look into the lives of an aging magazine publisher's harem, women are often the brightly polished trophies in the display case of reality television. The genre has developed a very successful formula for reducing women to an awkward series of stereotypes about low self-esteem, marital desperation, the inability to develop meaningful relationships with other women, and an obsession with an almost pornographic standard of beauty. When it comes to reality television, women, more often than not, work very hard at performing the part of woman, though their scripts are shamefully, shamefully warped. Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV, by Jennifer Posner, skewers reality television for its sexist, racist, and dehumanizing tactics in nearly every genre of reality television. While I think of myself as media literate and a feminist, I don't know that any book I've read this year has made me as uncomfortable as Reality Bites Back for its incisive examination of what I have often thought of as harmless entertainment programming. I had to question what it says about me, that I take so much pleasure in the drama of the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, or the drunken, weave-snatching antics of Rock of Love or Flavor of Love. I, like many others, take pleasure in what Posner brands, quote, the cathartic display of other people's humiliations, end quote. These shows exist because audiences need reminders of the wrong turns our lives might take. In her analysis, Posner reveals the many tropes reality television exploits. Women as catty, bitchy, manipulative, and not to be trusted, for example. And how these tropes are coded into every aspect of these shows, from marketing to how the shows are scripted. The Green Girls Interrupted are manipulated into becoming the worst versions of themselves. And while certainly anyone who goes on a reality television show in this day and age has a certain level of reality sophistication, one gets the impression from Posner's critique that these Green Girls do not have the intimate self-awareness of a Ruth or a Maria Wyatt. They don't have an opportunity to develop this self-awareness because the reality of reality television is so heavily constructed that these women can only be aware of the artifice surrounding them and the parts they are scripted to play within that artifice. Perhaps no reality television better exemplifies the Green Girl Interrupted, the Green Girl wholly aware of the artifice surrounding her and somewhat complicit in maintaining that artifice, than VH1's now-defunct celebreality shows Rock of Love and Flavor of Love. In Rock of Love, women vied for the affections of fading rock star Bret Michaels, while in Flavor of Love, the women vied for the affections of has-been hype man Flavor Flav of Public Enemy. In each of these shows, the women deftly play the part of bad green girl or good green girl or good green girl gone bad, each pretending the former star is the center of the romantic universe amid freely flowing alcohol, forced interactions designed to create artificial but vicious conflict, writhing on stripper poles, and other luridly spectacular scenes. In Flavor of Love, the women don't even keep their real names. Instead, Flav, as the women call him, assigns each woman a new name of his choosing because he cannot be bothered to see the Green Girl Interrupted for who she really is. The names range from the silly, smiley, to the degrading, Thing One and Thing Two. The show's artifice allows these women to easily step into constructed identities through this renaming. The women are undoubtedly exploited, but they often seem resigned to it and willing to revel in that exploitation rather than challenge it. In both shows, across multiple seasons, these Green Girls Interrupted go through the motions of looking for true love with men who are contributing to the artifice by spouting hollow sentiments and platitudes as a means of seduction, while metaphorically winking at the camera to let us know they know how unreal their reality is, usually during the unscripted confessionals. The exploitation and these women's participation in it continued when many of the women from both shows went on to appear on spin-offs with equally artificial premises like Rock of Love Charm School, Charm School with Ricky Lake, I Love Money, several shows for former Flavor of Love contestant New York, aka Tiffany Pollard, and on and on. During each of these shows, these women rarely demonstrate any self-awareness. Instead, they reveal how intimately aware they are of the artifice around them and what that artifice will bring them. Attention, a modicum of fame, money. These Green Girls Interrupted are the parts they must play. And within the context of these shows, they do not evolve beyond those roles. They remain interrupted. If reality television has any connection to reality, it is that women are often called upon to perform their gender, whether through how they present themselves and their sexuality, how they behave, and how they conform or don't to society's expectations for women. The repetition of gender acts in reality television becomes grossly stylized through artificially tanned skin, elaborate hair extensions, dramatic makeup, surgically enhanced bodies, and chemically injected faces. The acts become grossly stylized through bad behavior, often carefully orchestrated by producers. Under the persistent glare of the camera, these women have little choice but to sacrifice themselves for our entertainment. The women of reality television are perhaps the greenest of girls. Women who revel in watching themselves suffer because they have been so irrevocably interrupted they do not know what else they should do. We can't look away. These women, these interrupted Ruths and Marias, look at their ruin. They are such garish, glorious spectacles. At the end of Green Girl, Ruth wants some kind of rebirth, some way of making herself clean. She wants to, quote, smash that thing that houses me inside of myself, end quote. She decides, quote, I want to go to a church and direct my eyes up high and open my arms up to the ceiling and scream. And scream, and scream, end quote. She wants to scream in both agony and ecstasy. She wants to lose herself as much as she wants to find herself. The same thing could be said for Maria Wyeth. And perhaps the same thing could be said for the women of reality television as they break themselves against one another, against the camera, against the ways they are expected to perform their gender. What may be most terrifying is just how real reality television is, after all. We say we watch these shows to feel better about ourselves, to have that reassurance that we are not that desperate, we are not that green. But perhaps we watch these shows because in The Green Girls Interrupted, we see, more than anything, the plainest reflections of ourselves, garishly exposed, but unfettered. Not here to make friends. My memory of men is never lit up and illuminated like my memory of women. Marguerite Duras, The Lover. In my high school yearbook, there was a note from a girl who wrote, I like you, even though you are very mean. I do not remember the girl who wrote this note. I do not remember being mean to her, or to anyone, for that matter. I do remember that I was feral in high school, socially awkward, emotionally closed off, completely lost. Or maybe I don't want to remember being mean because I've changed in the 20 years between then and now. Around my junior year, I went from being quiet and withdrawn to being mean, where mean was saying exactly what I thought and making sarcastic comments relentlessly. Sincerity was dead to me. I had so few friends it didn't really matter how I behaved. I had nothing to lose. I had no idea what it meant to be likable, though I was surrounded by generally likable people. Or, I suppose, I was surrounded by people who were very invested in projecting a likable facade. People who were willing to play by the rules. I had likable parents and brothers. I was the anomaly as a social outcast. Even from a young age, I understood that when a girl is unlikable, a girl is a problem. I also understood that I wasn't being intentionally mean. I was being honest, admittedly without tact, and I was being human. It is either a blessing or a curse that those are rarely likable qualities in a woman. Inevitably, on every reality television program, someone will boldly declare, "I'm not here to make friends." These people do so to establish that they are on a given program to win the nebulous prize or the bachelor's heart or to get the exposure they need to begin their unsteady rise to a modicum of fame. They make this declaration by way of explaining their unlikability or the inevitably unkind edit they're going to receive from the show's producers. It isn't that they are terrible, you see. It's simply that they are not participating in the show to make friends. They are freeing themselves from the burden of likability, or they are, perhaps, freeing us from the burden of guilt for the dislike and eventual contempt we might hold for them. In the movie Young Adult, Charlize Theron stars as Mavis Gary. Nearly every review of the movie raises her character's unlikability, painting her with a bright scarlet U. Based on this character's critical reception, an unlikable woman embodies any number of unpleasing but entirely human characteristics. Mavis is beautiful, cold, calculating, self-absorbed, full of odd tics, insensitive, and largely dysfunctional in nearly every aspect of her life. These are apparently unacceptable traits for a woman, particularly given the sheer number working in concert. Some reviews go so far as to suggest that Mavis is mentally ill, because there's nothing more reliable than armchair diagnosis by disapproving critics. In his review, Roger Ebert lauds Young Adult screenwriter Diablo Cody for making Mavis an alcoholic because, without such a context, Mavis would simply be insane. Ebert and many others require an explanation for Mavis's behavior. They require a diagnosis for her unlikability in order to tolerate her. The simplest explanation of Mavis as human will not suffice. In many ways, likability is a very elaborate lie, a performance, a code of conduct dictating the proper way to be. Characters who don't follow this code become unlikable. Critics who criticize a character's unlikability cannot necessarily be faulted. They are merely expressing a wider cultural malaise with all things unpleasant, all things that dare to breach the norm of social acceptability. Why is likability even a question? Why are we so concerned with whether, in fact or fiction, someone is likable? Unlikable is a fluid designation that can be applied to any character who doesn't behave in a way the reader finds palatable. Lionel Shriver notes in an essay for the Financial Times that this liking business has two components, moral approval and affection. We need characters to be lovable while they do right. Some might suggest that this likability question is a byproduct of an online culture in which we reflexively click like or favorite on every status update and bit of personal trivia shared on social networks. Certainly there is a culture of relentless affirmation online, but it would be short-sighted to believe that this desire to be liked, this desire to express what or whom we like, begins or ends with the internet. I have no doubt that Abraham Maslow has some ideas about this persistent desire, in so many of us, to be liked and, in turn, to belong, to have our deftness at following the proper code of conduct affirmed. As a writer and a person who has struggled with likability, being likable, wanting to be liked, wanting to belong, I have spent a great deal of time thinking about likability in the stories I read and those I write. I am often drawn to unlikable characters, to those who behave in socially unacceptable ways, say whatever is on their mind, and do what they want with varying levels of regard for the consequences. I want characters to do bad things and get away with their misdeeds. I want characters to think ugly thoughts and make ugly decisions. I want characters to make mistakes and put themselves first without apologizing for it. I don't even mind unlikable characters whose behavior is psychopathic or sociopathic. This is not to say I condone, for example, murder, but Patrick Bateman in American Psycho is a very interesting man. There is a psychiatric diagnosis for his unlikability, a deviant pathology, but he has his charms, particularly in his scathing self-awareness. Serial killers are people too, and sometimes they are funny. My conscience, Bateman thinks in the novel, my pity, my hopes disappeared a long time ago, probably at Harvard, if they ever did exist. I want characters to do the things I am afraid to do for fear of making myself more unlikable than I may already be. I want characters to be the most honest of all things. Human. That the question of likability even exists in literary conversations is odd. It implies that we are engaging in a courtship. When characters are unlikable, they don't meet our mutable, varying standards. Certainly we can find kinship in fiction, but literary merit shouldn't be dictated by whether we want to be friends or lovers with those about whom we read. Frankly, I find good, purportedly likable characters rather unbearable. Take Mae Welland in Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence. Mae's likability is, to be fair, deliberate, a choice Wharton has made so Newland Archer's passion for Countess Olenska is ever more fraught and bittersweet. Still, Mae is the kind of woman who always does everything right, everything that is expected of her. She is a perfect society lady. She knows how to keep up appearances. Meanwhile, everyone looks down on May's unspoken rival and cousin, the Countess Olenska, a woman who dares to defy social conventions, who dares to not tolerate a terrible marriage, who dares to want real passion in her life, even if that passion is found with an unsuitable man. We're not supposed to like her. But Countess Olenska intrigues me because she is interesting. She stands apart from the blur of social conformity. We're supposed to like, or at least respect, May for being the proper and sweet innocent she carries herself as. But in Wharton's skilled hands, we eventually see that May Welland is as human and therefore as unlikable as anyone else. This question of likability would be far more tolerable if all writers were as talented as Edith Wharton. But alas, far more pernicious than the characters whose likability serves a greater purpose within a narrative are the characters who are flatly likable. It's a bit silly, but I spend a great deal of time, even now, lamenting the perfection of one Elizabeth Wakefield, one of the two golden twins prominently featured in the popular Sweet Valley High young adult series. Elizabeth is the good girl who always makes the right choices, even when she has to sacrifice her own happiness. She gets good grades. She's a good daughter, sister, and girlfriend. It's boring. Elizabeth's likability is downright loathsome. I am Team Jessica. I prefer Nellie Olson over Laura Ingalls Wilder. This matter of likability is largely a futile one. Oftentimes, a likable character is simply designed as such to show that he or she is one who knows how to play by the rules and cares to be seen as playing by the rules. The likable character, like the unlikable character, is generally used to make some greater narrative point. Often in literary criticism, writers are told that a character isn't likable, as if a character's likability is directly proportional to the quality of a novel's writing. This is particularly true for women in fiction. In literature, as in life, the rules are all too often different for girls. There are many instances in which an unlikable man is billed as an anti-hero, earning a special term to explain those ways in which he deviates from the norm, the traditionally likable. The list, beginning with Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye, is long. An unlikable man is inscrutably interesting, dark, or tormented, but ultimately compelling, even when he might behave in distasteful ways. This is the only explanation I can come up with for the popularity of, say, the novels of Philip Roth, who is one hell of a writer, but who also practically revels in the unlikability of his men, with their neuroses and self-loathing, and, of course, humanity. Boldly on display from one page to the next. When women are unlikable, it becomes a point of obsession in critical conversations by professional and amateur critics alike. Why are these women daring to flaunt convention? Why aren't they making themselves likable, and therefore acceptable, to polite society? In a Publisher's Weekly interview with Claire Massoud about her novel The Woman Upstairs, which features a rather unlikable protagonist, Nora, who is bitter, bereft, and downright angry about what her life has become, the interviewer said, "I wouldn't want to be friends with Nora, would you? Her outlook is almost unbearably grim." And there we have it. A reader was here to make friends with the characters in a book, and she didn't like what she found. Massoud, for her part, had a sharp response for her interviewer. "For heaven's sake, what kind of question is that? Would you want to be friends with Humbert Humbert? Would you want to be friends with Mickey Sabbath? Saleem Sinai? Hamlet? Crap? Oedipus? Oscar Wow? Antigone? Raskolnikov? Any of the characters in The Corrections? Any of the characters in Infinite Jest? Any of the characters in anything Pynchon has ever written? Or Martin Amis? Or Orhan Pamuk? Or Alice Munro, for that matter? If you're reading to find friends, you're in deep trouble. We read to find life in all its possibilities. The relevant question isn't, is this a potential friend for me? But is this character alive?" Perhaps, then, unlikable characters, the ones who are the most human, are also the ones who are the most alive. Perhaps this intimacy makes us uncomfortable because we don't dare be so alive. In How Fiction Works, James Wood says, "A great deal of nonsense is written every day about characters in fiction, from the side of those who believe too much in character and from the side of those who believe too little. Those who believe too much have an iron set of prejudices about what characters are. We should get to know them. They should grow and develop, and they should be nice. So they should be pretty much like us." Wood is correct, in part. But the ongoing question of character likability leaves the impression that what we're looking for in fiction is an ideal world where people behave in ideal ways. The question suggests that characters should be reflections not of us, but of our better selves. Wood also says, "There is nothing harder than the creation of fictional character." I can attest to this difficulty, though with perhaps less hyperbole. I have indeed found several other tasks harder over the years. Regardless, characters are hard to create because we need to develop people who are interesting enough to hold a reader's attention. We need to ensure that they are some measure of credible. We need to make them distinct from ourselves and, in the best of all words, from those in our lives, unless, of course, there is a need to settle scores. Somehow they need to be well-developed enough to carry a plot, or carry a narrative without a plot, or endure the tribulations we writers tend to throw at them with alacrity. It's no wonder so many characters are unlikable, given what they have to put up with. It is a seductive position writers put the reader in when they create an interesting, unlikable character. They make the reader complicit in ways that are both uncomfortable and intriguing. If people with messy lives are the point of certain narratives, if unlikable women are the point of certain narratives, novels like Battleborn, Treasure Island, Dare Me, Magnificence, and many others exhibit a delightful excess of purpose, with stories filled with women who are deemed unlikable because they make so-called bad choices, describe the world exactly as they see it, and are ultimately honest and breathtakingly alive. These novels depict women who are clearly not participating in their narratives to make friends, and whose characters are the better for it. Freed from the constraints of likability, they are able to exist on and beyond the page as fully realized, interesting, and realistic characters. Perhaps the saying, "The truth hurts," is what lies at the heart of worrying over likability, or the lack thereof. How much of the truth we're willing to subject ourselves to. How much we are willing to hurt when we immerse ourselves in the safety of a fictional world. Sarah Levine's Treasure Island features a narrator who is unlikable in curious ways. She is utterly self-obsessed, acts without considering consequences, and always makes choices that will benefit herself over others. She is intensely preoccupied with the book Treasure Island and sets out to live her life by the book's core values: boldness, resolution, independence, and horn-blowing. As the narrator careens from one self-created disaster to another, she is unrepentant. There is no redemption or lesson learned from misdeeds. There is no apology or moral to the story. And that makes an already incisive and intelligent novel even more compelling. When you think about it, these core values the narrator in Treasure Island seeks to live by, boldness, resolution, independence, and horn-blowing, are characteristics that define how supposedly unlikable women lead their fictional lives. In Pamela Ribbon's You Take It From Here, a woman, Smidge, is dying of lung cancer and wants her best friend, Danielle, to essentially finish the job of raising her daughter and being her husband's companion in grief. The book's premise is an interesting one, but what really stands apart is how deeply unlikable Smidge is. She is the kind of person who, it might seem, shouldn't have any friends. Bossy, intense, controlling, unrepentant, and manipulative. And yet, she has a best friend, a daughter, a husband, and a community of people who will deeply mourn her when she is gone. Ribbon's steadfastness in this character's lack of likability is admirable. She never panders by making Smidge somehow have some kind of epiphany of character simply because she is dying. Ribbon is unwavering in what she shows us of Smidge, and the novel is the better for it. A customer review of You Take It From Here on Amazon.com from Danae Savitri states, "I never warmed up to Smidge as a character, thought she suffered from borderline personality disorder, common among people who are charismatic narcissists, who alternately bully, manipulate, and charm others around them." Instead of judging the book, she calls into question a woman's likability. Again, there is an armchair diagnosis of mental disease. Pathologizing the unlikable in fictional characters is an almost Pavlovian response. Dare Me by Megan Abbott is a book about high school cheerleaders, but it is nothing like what you might expect. Populated by women who act with boldness, resolve, independence, and a prioritizing of the self, these mighty principles from Treasure Island. Dare Me is both engaging and terrifying because it reveals the fraught intimacy between girls. It's a novel about bodies and striving for perfection and ambition and desire so naked, so palpable, you cannot help but want the deeply flawed women in the book to get what they want, no matter how terribly they go about getting it. The young women at the center of the novel, Beth and Addie, are friends as much as they are enemies. They betray each other, and they betray themselves. They commit wrongs, and still they are each other's gravitational center. On the phone, after a drunken night, Beth asks Addie if she remembers how we used to hang on the monkey bars, hooking our legs around each other, and how strong we got, and how no one could ever beat us, and we could never beat each other, but we'd agree to each release our hands at the count of three, and that she always cheated, and I always let her, standing beneath, looking up at her, and grinning my gap-toothed pre-orthodontic grin. It is a moment that shows us how Addie has always seen Beth plainly, and understood her, and loved her nonetheless. Throughout the novel, Beth, and Addie to an extent, remains unlikable, remains flawed. But there is no explanation for it, no clear trajectory between cause and effect. Traditional parameters of likability are deftly avoided throughout the novel in moments as honest and no less poignant as these. Susan Lindley, a widow, has to move on after her husband's tragic death in Lydia Millett's Magnificence. From the outset, we know she was unfaithful to her husband. She inherits her uncle's mansion, filled with a rotting taxidermy collection, and sets about making some kind of order, both in the mansion and in her own life. She has a daughter who is involved with her boss, and a boyfriend who is married to another woman. She feels responsible for her husband's death, but is matter of fact in reconciling herself to this. Was she relieved, slut that she was? Susan thinks. Was there something in her that was relieved by any of this? If anyone could admit such a thing, she should be able to. She was not only a slut, but a killer. Susan does go on to acknowledge that she feels a profound absence in the loss of her husband, a freedom of nothing. And throughout the novel, she indulges in this freedom. She embraces it. So much of Magnificence is grounded solely in Susan's experiences, her awkward perceptions of the world she has created and continues to create for herself. We also have the pleasure of seeing a woman in her late 40s as a deeply sexual being who is equally unashamed in her want for material things as she becomes more and more attached to the mansion she has inherited. Though the prose often gives over to lush excess and meditation, what remains compelling is this woman who reveals little remorse for her infidelities and the ways she tends to fail the people in her life. In a lesser novel, such remorse would be the primary narrative thrust. But in Magnificence, we see how a woman, one deemed unlikable by many, is able to exist and be part of a story that expands far beyond remorse and the kinds of entrapments that could hold likable characters back. We are able to see just what the freedom of nothing looks like. The short story collection Battleborn by Claire V. Watkins contains many stories with seemingly unlikable women. As much as the stories are about place, all set in some form in the desert of the American West, several stories are about women and their strength, where their strength comes from, and how that strength can fail in unbearably human ways. The phrase Battleborn is in fact Nevada's state motto, meant to represent the state's strength, forged from struggle. In perhaps the most powerful story, Rondine al Nido, There is an epigraph at the beginning. Normally, I do not care for epigraphs. I don't want my reading of a story to be framed by the writer in such an overt way. This story's epigraph, though, is from the Bhagavad Gita, and reads, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." From the outset, we know that only ruin lies ahead, and the story becomes a matter of learning just how that ruin comes about. We learn of a woman who, quote, "walks out on a man who in the end she'll decide didn't love her enough, though he, in fact, did love her. But his love wrenched something inside him, and this caused him to hurt her," end quote. Really, though, this is a story about when the woman was a girl, 16, with a friend, Lena, the kind who would follow the narrator, our girl, wherever she went. There is an evening in Las Vegas and an incident in a hotel room with some boys the girls meet, one that will irrevocably change the friendship, one that could have been avoided if a flawed young woman didn't make the wrong choice, the choice that makes the story everything. Perhaps the most unlikable woman in recent fictional memory is Amy in Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl. A woman who goes to extraordinary lengths, faking her own murder and framing her husband, Nick, to punish his infidelity and keep him within her grasp. Amy was so excessively unlikable, so unrepentant, so shameless, that at times this book is intensely uncomfortable. Flynn engages in a clever manipulation in which we learn more and more about both Nick and Amy in small moments, so that we never quite know how to feel about them. We never quite know if they are likable or unlikable, and then we do know that they are both flawed, both terrible, and stuck together in many ways. And it is exhilarating to see a writer who doesn't blink, who doesn't pull back. There is a line of anger that runs throughout Gone Girl, and for Amy, that anger is born of the unreasonable burdens women are so often forced to bear. The novel is a psychological thriller, but it is also an exquisite character study. Amy is, by all accounts, a woman people should like. She's, quote, "a smart, pretty, nice girl with so many interests and enthusiasms, a cool job, a loving family, and let's say it, money," end quote. Even with all these assets, Amy finds herself single at 32. And then she finds Nick. The most uncomfortable aspect of Gone Girl is the book's honesty and how desperately similar many of us likely are to Nick and Amy in the ways they love and hate each other. The truth hurts. It hurts, it hurts, it hurts. When we finally begin to see the truth of Amy, she says of the night she met Nick, "That night at the Brooklyn party, I was playing the girl who was in style. The girl a man like Nick wants. The cool girl." Men always say that as the defining compliment, don't they? She's a cool girl. Being the cool girl means I am a hot, brilliant, funny woman who adores football, poker, dirty jokes, and burping, who plays video games, drinks cheap beer, loves threesomes and anal sex, and jams hot dogs and hamburgers into her mouth like she's hosting the world's biggest culinary gangbang while somehow maintaining a size 2. Because cool girls are, above all, hot. Hot and understanding. Men actually think this girl exists. Maybe they're fooled because so many women are willing to pretend to be this girl. This is what is so rarely said about unlikable women in fiction. That they aren't pretending. That they won't or can't pretend to be someone they are not. They have neither the energy for it nor the desire. They don't have the willingness of a Mae Whelan to play the part demanded of her. In Gone Girl, Amy talks about the temptation of being the woman a man wants. But ultimately, she doesn't give in to the temptation to be the girl who likes every fucking thing he likes and doesn't ever complain. Unlikable women refuse to give in to that temptation. They are, instead, themselves. They accept the consequences of their choices, and those consequences become stories worth reading. How We All Lose. Discussions about gender are often framed as either-or propositions. Men are from Mars and women are from Venus, or so we are told. As if this means we're all so different it is nigh impossible to reach each other. The way we talk about gender makes it easy to forget Mars and Venus are part of the same solar system, divided by only one planet, held in the thrall of the same sun. Unfortunately, many books released in 2012 did little to productively reframe the cultural conversation about gender. Instead, these books offered rather narrow insights into women and men and were at times disappointing for the opportunities they missed to bring nuance to how we think about gender. If women's fortunes improve, it must mean men's fortunes will suffer. As if there is a finite amount of good fortune in the universe that cannot be shared equally between men and women. This is certainly how I felt while reading Hannah Rosin's interesting and intelligent, but ultimately frustrating, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. What does it even mean to suggest that the end of men is explicitly connected to the rise of women? There's no denying women are doing better than they ever have. But is that really saying much? When you consider what life was like for women before suffrage, before Title IX, before the Equal Pay Act, before Roe v. Wade, before any number of changes that made life merely tolerable, most any success women encountered would seem like a rise in circumstance. Rosin has clearly done a great deal of research and makes compelling arguments. I particularly appreciated the way she tried to advance the conversation about gender by upending our expectations. So often when we talk about gender, we have tunnel vision, where we can only understand the lives of women as being grounded in disadvantage, the endless having it all debate, for example. Rosin complicates that notion by revealing the many ways women are gaining the upper hand in education, several industries, and the culture at large. I was skeptical as I read The End of Men, but Rosin makes it easy to respect many of her ideas. At the same time, it's pretty easy to frame an argument convincingly by being selective in the data presented. No writer or critic is free from this selectivity, but at times it stands out as problematic in The End of Men. In the chapter Farm Girls, How Women Remade the Economy, Rosin discusses the rise of women in the pharmaceutical industry. She notes that in 2009, for the first time in American history, the balance of the workforce tipped toward women, who continued to hover around 50%. This is an encouraging, important statistic, but according to 2010 census data, women still earn 77% of what men earn, and that cannot be ignored. We make up half the workforce, but pay a pretty steep price for that privilege. Throughout the chapter, Rosin highlights the great strides women have made as pharmacists, how they are practically dominating the field, and it is truly inspiring to see how far we've come in a field once entirely male-dominated. At the same time, this is only one field. For every argument, there is a counter-argument. Women are doing well in pharmacy, but the statistics are starkly different in, say, the sciences and most engineering disciplines. One of the recurrent themes throughout The End of Men is that of female ambition. Women are working harder, are more focused, and are willing to do what it takes to fulfill their responsibilities, both personally and professionally. At many colleges and universities, women are the majority, while men are choosing not to enroll or not to finish their college degrees. Rosin doesn't do enough, though, to explore why this trend has emerged. She highlights the fact that there was a time when men didn't have to go to college. They could work in manufacturing or learn a trade and make a good living for themselves and their families. As more manufacturing jobs have gone overseas and the economy has collapsed, however, nothing has replaced these jobs. Men haven't adapted. What goes unsaid is that women might be more ambitious and focused because we've never had a choice. We've had to fight to vote, to work outside the home, to work in environments free of sexual harassment, to attend the universities of our choice, and we've also had to prove ourselves over and over to receive any modicum of consideration. Women are rising, but Hillary Clinton, a former Secretary of State and potential presidential candidate in 2016, still must answer questions about fashion. CNN feels comfortable publishing an article suggesting women's votes might be influenced by their hormones. And then Rosin discusses violence, the increase in female aggression, and notes that women today are far less likely to get murdered, raped, assaulted, or robbed than at any time in recent history. This is excellent news, but there's a curious aside when Rosin continues. A 2010 White House report on women and girls laid out the latest statistics straightforwardly to the great irritation of many feminists, but doesn't provide any evidence of this supposed feminist irritation. It is hard to accept at face value that feminists would be irritated that there's a decline in violence against women, as if the rise of women is somehow antithetical to the feminist agenda. Rosin goes on to cite several other statistics without acknowledging how much abuse and sexual violence goes unreported. The truth is that we'll never have a truly accurate statistical count for the violence women, or men for that matter, experience. We can only make best guesses. Another advance Rosin touts is how the definition of rape has expanded to include acts that stop short of penetration, oral sex, for example, and circumstances in which the victim was too incapacitated, usually meaning too drunk, to give meaningful consent. This has been a critical improvement in acknowledging the breadth of sexual violence. But we also have to consider the many different kinds of rape we have learned about over the past few years as conservative politicians blunder through trying to explain their stances on sexual violence and abortion. For instance, Indiana Treasurer Richard Murdoch, running for the U.S. Senate in 2012, said in a debate, "I struggled with it myself for a long time, and I realized that life is a gift from God. And I think even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something God intended to happen." I've been obsessing over these words and trying to understand how someone who purports to believe in God can also believe that anything born of rape is God intended. Just as there are many different kinds of rape, there are many different kinds of God. I am also reminded that women, more often than not, are the recipient of God's intentions and must also bear the burdens of these intentions. Murdoch is certainly not alone in offering up opinions about rape. Former Missouri Representative Todd Akin believes in legitimate rape and the oxymoronic forcible rape, not to be confused with all that illegitimate rape going on. Ron Paul believes in the existence of honest rape, but turns a blind eye to the dishonest rapes out there. Former Wisconsin State Representative Roger Rivard believes some girls, they rape so easy. Lest you think these new definitions of rape are only the purview of men, failed Senate candidate Linda McMahon of Connecticut has introduced us to the idea of emergency rape. Given this bizarre array of new rape definitions, it is hard to reconcile the belief that women are rising when there is still so much in our cultural climate working to hold women down. We can, I suppose, take comfort in knowing that none of these